I want to thank both of you for joining us this morning. One more time, how do people get involved and stay in touch with y'all? And of course, we will also post this to our Facebook page for folks that don't have a pen in hand right now. But let's start with you, David. How do people get involved with Alliance for Democracy?
Well, they can contact me directly at davidafd@ymail.com. We do have our website, afd-pdx.org. And we're on Facebook, although I don't remember what our Facebook name is. But
well, we'll figure that out, and we'll.
I posted them on Facebook on our on the Positively Revolting.
Actually,
Facebook.
I think Lynn already has. Yeah.
Oh, okay. And best way to get a hold of Oregon Fair Trade Campaign is m.shannon, S-H-A-N-N-O-N, at OregonFairTrade.org. That's also our website, OregonFairTrade.org, and we're Oregon Fair Trade Campaign on Facebook.
All right. Thank you both for joining us this morning. We are completely out of time. We'll see you again next week.
Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Mayoral Candidate Forum on Social Justice, March 10th at 6:30 p.m. at Maranatha Church in Portland. The forum will be a public conversation with leading mayoral candidates about social justice issues in our community. The program will be moderated by Israel Bayer of Street Roots, Joanne Hardesty of the NAACP Portland branch, and Jason Renault of the Mental Health Association of Portland. Again, that's the Mayoral Candidate Forum on Social Justice, Thursday, March 10th at 6:30 p.m. at Maranatha Church, 4222 Northeast 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 9:02 a.m. Coming up on Political Perspectives, nuclear whistleblower Aunt Arnie Gunderson speaks on Fukushima 5 years later. What did they know? When did they know it? At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, we hear Progressive Spirit and Islam 101, Meet Your Muslim Neighbor. Host John Shuck speaks with Manar Alatar, a PhD student at Portland State University in the School of the Environment. At 11:30 on the Radio Zine, host Per Fogring speaks with National Book Award-winning author Timothy Egan about his new book, The Immortal Irishman, The Irish Revolutionary Who Became an American Hero. And thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not currently a member of the KBOO Foundation, you can remedy that oversight at kboo.fm. Just click where it says Donate Today.
Diversity of time. Turns her voice into sugar water.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Fukushima, 5 years later. If you followed the internet news on the unfolding disaster that began in Fukushima on May 11, 2011, you are familiar with one voice for sure, Arne Gundersen of Fair Winds Associates. He brought all the important detail of the operation of nuclear power plants into the discussion. Gundersen is a licensed reactor operator and managed and coordinated projects at 70 nuclear power plants in the U.S. After 20 years as nuclear engineer and executive, Gundersen was fired from his job with Nuclear Energy Services in 1990, when he became a whistleblower on the lack of nuclear safety. Gundersen served as an expert witness in the investigation of the Three Mile Island accident and testified on the serious flaws of the Vermont Yankee, San Onofre, and Diablo Canyon nuclear power plants. Both Vermont Yankee and San Onofre are now in shutdown. In 2008, Gundersen's wife Maggie formed the nonprofit Fair Winds Energy Education. Their website features videos and podcasts, as well as blog posts on current events, expert witness reports on nuclear safety issues, a book list, media coverage, and much more. The website is widely used in Japan, and thanks to dedicated volunteer translators, is available in 4 languages. And this radio program gives you a sense of the work done through that website. On the 5th anniversary of the Fukushima accident, Arne Gundersen is spending a month in Japan to assess the status of the cleanup and follow-up. He comes to Japan at a very crucial moment, even though polls show that at least 70% of Japanese do not want the nuclear power plants reopened that were shut down 5 years ago. The Abe government is determined to put many of them back online and has begun the process. And to make things worse, the Japanese government is planning to burn plutonium mixed with uranium in their aging reactors, a practice that has been abandoned in the U.S. due to the high risk. Gundersen was invited to speak to community groups and NGOs across Japan. He's traveling with a group of scientists and a representative of NIRS, the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. Mary Olson plans to focus on the health effects on women and children. All research and experience show that women and children are especially vulnerable to radiation. As I'm preparing this radio program for broadcast, Gundersen and Olson have arrived in Japan at the first stop, Fukushima Prefecture. Like all visitors to the area, they came equipped with their own Geiger counters. Gundersen spoke with Maggie Gundersen at Fair Winds to phone in his first report. He had taken the bullet train to Fukushima City and drove by car to some of the ghost towns that surround the power plant.
I'll tell you, the devastation's just awful. You go by beautiful homes and they're abandoned. You know, there's snow in the mountains and there's, you know, the driveways aren't plowed and the places are beginning to get run down. And in their front yard, you'll see dozens of bags, and each bag weighs a ton filled with dirt. There's 30 million bags weighing 30 million tons of radioactive dirt and radioactive tree leaves and everything. And then, of course, all the rice paddies are loaded with plastic bags full of radioactive material, so they're not going to be, you know, growing rice there for a long time. Then we found a parking lot at a supermarket that had a large radioactive source right in the middle of the parking lot that people were walking over and driving over. It was loaded with a black radioactive dust. So just wherever you go, It's everywhere. And every house we saw was abandoned. Then you get into a small town that is open during the day for the construction people. And then they close down when the construction people leave. Wherever you go, there's constant reminders that everything's radioactive. Big orange signs on the side of the road saying, you know, this area is not under construction, but this area is being decontaminated. Then we go to areas that were complete, and they're radioactive as all heck. So as soon as they clean it, it rains, and it becomes contaminated again.
Why is that? Why does the rain bring it in again? Is that washing down from the mountains or the hillsides, or is that washing from the site, or is it radioactivity still exuding from the site that's being redeposited?
Well, they're only cleaning 20 feet on every side of the road. So all the dust and debris that's up in the forests is being blown by the wind or washed by the rain right into people's front yards again. One of the samples that one of my fellow scientists collected showed plutonium. And significant amounts of plutonium. He was getting 19 disintegrations per second of plutonium. And, you know, that stuff hangs around for a quarter of a million years.
That plutonium was part of the core that came out then in the explosion, correct?
Yeah. The only source it could ever have come from was inside that nuclear reactor. Fukushima City is relatively clean. It's 40 miles away from the site. So I'm with three carloads of scientists. And as we left Fukushima City, their radiation detectors were reading about 40 counts per minute. And then as we got into the hills between Fukushima City and the power plant, the radiation detectors went up to 400, 10 times what it was in the city. And there's heavy snow everywhere. There's at least a foot of snow in the mountains. So that's acting as shielding and preventing these numbers from even being higher. We went out to a incinerator. It's under construction. And they plan to burn 10 tons a day of material. Well, there's 30 million tons of material up here. So that means they'll have it all done in 3 million days. That's a long, 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 long time. 1,000 years.
1,000 years?
Yeah, this incinerator's not working yet, but their throughput is estimated to be 10 tons a day. All of those particles are up there in the hills, and there's no way that any number of human beings could go up into an entire mountainside. Some of these mountains are 8,000 feet high. So to go up into them and clean a mountain range is just beyond the capability of human beings. So what happens is every time it snows or every time it rains, it washes down into these villages and it washes down into the Pacific. In these hills around Fukushima, there's monkeys. And we saw one today, as a matter of fact, running across the road. And one of the scientists watched the monkey poop and then collected the poop. And the monkey poop had 50,000 becquerels per kilogram of cesium in it. So, you know, these animals that are living up there in the forests are becoming more and more and more highly radioactive. You know, the impression I get is the futility of the cleanup. I mean, these areas that scientists I'm with sampled today were supposedly clean, and they're highly radioactive again. This deep sadness of seeing these beautiful family homes just abandoned and likely to remain abandoned for a lifetime. So the futility and the sadness, I think, are the two things that weigh on me the most as I go to bed tonight.
That was part of the first phoned-in report by Arne Gundersen. He is on a one-month journey to Japan to assess the status of the cleanup of the Fukushima accident. From here, he will travel on to Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Kobe, Kyoto, and the Osaka Global Environmental Forum. Gundersen is chief engineer of Fairwinds Associates and on the board of directors for Fairwinds Energy Education. That's a 501c3 nonprofit. Just before leaving for Japan, Arne Gundersen sat down with the staff of Fairwinds Energy Education, his wife Maggie, and Toby Aronson and Caroline Phillips. They went over the information that is so crucial in understanding the current situation in Japan. First, here's Arne Gundersen addressing the claim by TEPCO that the cleanup of the land around the Fukushima power plants is well underway, facilitating a possible return of some of the evacuated residents.
The country's seriously contaminated even now. People that live in the prefecture are living in what we would call an RCA, and that stands for a radiologically contaminated area. If that were in the States, if that were in a nuclear power plant, those kinds of levels of radiation would require that you couldn't walk into those areas without health physics support.
Currently, there are a lot of people who are dislocated, but are people also returning to these contaminated areas as well right now?
Yeah, I think they're being forced to go back in. You got to remember, there's 160,000 people that were evacuated originally, and now the number's just a hair under 100,000. So 60,000 have gone back into areas that we would consider, by United States standards, highly contaminated. But what the Japanese did was they raised the standards, and they took away the money from these people when they were in housing, not in the prefecture. So they said, if you want to continue with the stipend we have you on, you've got to go home. So it's basically they're forcing them back into an area that's much more radioactive than it was when they left.
So Arne, not only are people moving back into contaminated areas, but we also have some nuclear power plants in Japan starting up again. Can you talk about some concerns regarding that issue?
Yeah, Toby, that's a great question. You know, there were 54 nuclear power plants in Japan operating right before the Great East Earthquake and the disaster at Fukushima Daiichi. Well, there were 4 units at Daiichi wiped out, plus there were 2 others that will never start again. Plus, there were 4 others just down the road at Fukushima Daini. So 10 nuclear reactors will essentially never operate again because they're in Fukushima Prefecture. In addition, at least another 10 or 15 are too old to operate and should have been shut down even before the earthquake. So that 54 units has tumbled down to about 26. Of those 26, the Japanese are frantically trying to get them back up and running. And the real reason behind it all is, you've heard it before, money. The banks have put a lot of money into maintaining those 26 power plants and paying for the staffs to sit there essentially idle for the last 5 years. They want their money back. And the only way to get their money back is to turn those nukes back on. So what's happened in the last 5 years is that the Japanese haven't really made these plants any stronger. What they've done is they've reanalyzed all of their calculations and taken away all the margins of safety and said that, well, a stronger earthquake, these plants can withstand. But in fact, there's been no major changes to the structure. It's frightening. You know, these plants were built by people my age when we got out of college in the 70s. They're old. And the Japanese refuse to acknowledge that it was a bad bet then, and they're going to double down on a bad bet now. The Abe regime is very pro-business, and the banks have deep inroads into the Abe regime. And on top of that, the 10 utilities that run all of the power grid in Japan are little fiefdoms that have incredible pressure in their parliament diet. So politically, the pressure from the banks, the pressure from these 10 power companies, Tokyo Electric is only one of 10, and the Abe regime are totally ignoring what the public wants. And you're right, it's at least 70% of the Japanese, including almost every woman and just about half the men, don't want nuclear power to operate again, but it's being ramrodded through by financial interests that just don't care about public health and safety.
when there were no nuclear reactors in Japan going, I never read about any blackouts or power outages. And my question is, how is Japan meeting its energy needs without all of the nuclear reactors that haven't been restarted or will not be restarted? Are they necessary?
Yeah, there's a couple of answers to that, Caroline. It's a great question. The first is that the Japanese power grid is really nowhere near a world power grid. They have 10 little fiefdoms, and they don't share power across the grid. So you've got TEPCO to the north and Chubu to the south of Tokyo, and each has an enormous overcapacity in case one unit goes down. In the United States, we have a shared grid. We pool our power. In Japan, they don't. Matter of fact, in Western Japan, they're at 50 cycles per second. And in Eastern Japan, they're at 60 cycles per second. So they can't even agree on how many cycles per second the electricity should flow at. So when all these units shut down, there's a lot of excess capacity sitting around anyway. And it was largely gas and largely coal. So what happened is two things. First, and the Japanese really deserve an enormous amount of credit, they conserved like crazy. They really went on an efficiency kick. I was in office buildings where the temperature inside was 78 in the summer. And it wasn't bad. You know, they realized that they were overcooling in the summer and overheating in the winter. So the Japanese really went into an energy efficiency and a conservation mode. They did import more coal and gas. And then they also brought in the equivalent of about 6 nuclear power plants worth of solar power. So they're beginning already to displace with solar power these old nukes. And you're right, there were no blackouts. Tokyo remained well over-illuminated, trust me. And life went on.
Arnie, I have a follow-up question to that. You touched on solar. What is the actual progress with renewables?
Well, there's enormous pressure by these 10 utilities that we talked about. You know, the 10 governing electric boards, essentially, are putting enormous pressure on the diet so that renewables are being stifled. But even despite that, people are doing it, and corporations are doing it. You know, the interesting thing is that even before the disaster at Fukushima Daiichi, Japan had the highest electrical rates in the industrial world. And that's an incredible burden. And now they're going to be higher because they just, you know, paid for 5 years of nuclear plants that didn't run, and they want that money back too. So electric costs in Japan are arbitrarily high because these 10 powerhouse utilities control the diet, control the parliament, and the people are getting stuck with high rates. So now we've got high rates that they pay for out of their wall socket, and they're realizing, heck, I can go off the grid and put a solar collector on and get it cheaper. So they've priced themselves to a point where new solar is much, much cheaper than what they can get from the grid. And the big industries are realizing it too. The big industries are building their own power plants or building their own solar collectors so that they don't have to pay these exorbitant rates that the Japanese are being charged.
Arnie, moving on to issues regarding the outpour of radiation into the Pacific Ocean, there's been a lot of debate on exactly how contaminated is the Pacific Ocean. Is it affecting our food? Is it affecting our water quality?
Yeah, Toby, the Japanese are focusing on leaks from the Fukushima power plants. And, you know, that's probably a mile of coastline, and it is severely contaminated, and it continues to bleed into the Pacific every day. But what no one is paying any attention to is that the entire mountain range that runs 100 miles up and down this coast is also contaminated. And as much radiation is pouring out into the rivers and streams, into the Pacific from the mountain range because it's so contaminated, as from the Fukushima site. So, you know, Tokyo Electric would have you just look at the site and say, well, we're doing things to collect the radiation. But in fact, they've got an entire state pouring radiation into the Pacific. So what's in the Pacific? Off of California, they're finding radiation at what I would consider significant levels. A cubic meter is about 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet. And in a cubic meter of ocean water, they're finding 10 radioactive decays every second. That's called the disintegration. So that's called 10 becquerels per cubic meter. So a cubic meter of water, if you were in a dark room, would have 10 flashes of light every second, and that's going to go on for 300 years. So we have contaminated the biggest source of water on the planet, and there's no way to stop it.
So are you saying that the contaminated water problem is hopeless?
It used to be that scientists believed dilution is the solution to pollution. But I think we're finding with the biggest body of water on the planet that you can't dilute this stuff. And we're going to begin to see this bioaccumulation, which is all the fish that are in the ocean are going to uptake the cesium and the strontium and become more and more and more radioactive.
Arnie used the term bioaccumulation. If you could explain to our audience what exactly that means and sort of what that implies as far as, you know, food quality goes or water quality.
Well, if you think of it as there's radiation on the bottom of the Pacific, and that gets picked up by the whatever's on the bottom, the seaweed. And then little fish eat the seaweed, and little fish get eaten by bigger fish, and those fish get eaten by still bigger fish.
Every the time, circle of life.
Right. You know, and that process, every time they do that, the cesium in the little fish gets concentrated in the bigger fish. It's not just radioactivity. We know that about the mercury that's in tuna. The coal plants have thrown mercury out into the oceans, and it works its way up the food chain, too. So this concept of bioaccumulation doesn't just apply to radiation, but it is applying to fish in the food chain now.
I know that I haven't heard anything announced by the FDA, and I'm not a believer that the FDA would automatically say anything, but I know we don't have any substantiated radio levels in our seafood coming to the United States, but what is your stance? Do you eat out and take Maggie out to sushi regularly for bits of yellowfin tuna?
You know, the FDA limit is so high. It's 12 times higher for Americans than what it is for Japanese. So basically, if the Japanese find a fish that they can't eat, they can ship it to America and feed it to us, and the FDA doesn't care. So we've got a really high threshold. And on top of that, the FDA is hardly sampling fish at all. Less than a tenth of a percent of the fish that come into the United States are tested. Really, really small number. So my decision is I'm not eating fish from the Pacific. That's a personal decision. I never did eat yellowfin tuna, by the way, because they're such a beautiful fish. I just really couldn't stand, you know, killing one.
Arnie, while you're in Japan, I know that a number of presentations are set for you and you'll be traveling all over. In your presentations, what are you specifically talking about to these groups?
Yeah, the first thing I'll be talking about in Japan is the use of plutonium in their nuclear reactors for fuel. They call that MOX, mixed oxide fuel, but it's uranium and plutonium together inside a nuclear reactor. Running a reactor on plutonium is, one, really technically complicated, and two, expensive. There's not a reactor in America that uses MOX fuel, and there's none in the pipeline either. Why? Because our utilities are trying to minimize the cost, and it's actually cheaper to use uranium than it is for mixed oxide fuel. In Japan, they don't care. You know, as we talked about at the beginning here, the utilities that own these power plants have control over the rates. So they're paying more for this plutonium fuel. In America, not a power plant in the country uses plutonium for fuel because it's more complicated to license. And after a nuclear accident, it also complicates the accident analysis. So it's a real mess using plutonium. And I really want to talk about how I think it's a bad decision that plutonium will be used in Japanese reactors.
What do you think is the terrorist risk with MOX reactors?
You know, there's some brilliant people, and Frank von Hippel is probably at the top of the list at Princeton, who have been saying for 20 and 30 years that having plutonium driving down the highways to fuel a power plant is a real terrorist risk. And the reason is that if you capture a truck that's got plutonium and uranium in it, you can chemically separate out the plutonium and make a bomb. You don't need a real fancy gaseous diffusion plant and billions of dollars. You can chemically pull out the plutonium and make a bomb.
That was a conversation with Arne Gundersen that included Maggie Gundersen and staff at Fairwinds Energy Education. As a young man, Gundersen believed in the promise of nuclear power. He was a licensed reactor operator and managed projects at 70 nuclear power plants in the U.S. However, he became increasingly more aware of the high risks while at the same time observing serious safety breaches. He spoke out and became a whistleblower. After 20 years as nuclear engineer and executive, Gundersen was fired from his job in 1990. My thanks to Fairwinds and Maggie and Arne Gundersen for the material in this radio program that was recorded by them in February 2016. You can find the full podcast of their conversation and the phone calls from Japan on the website of fairwinds.org. That's Fairwinds with an E, F-A-I-R-E, winds.org. Fairwinds website has information on uranium mining and fuel, design and construction, decommissioning of nuclear power plants, and on waste and spent fuel. The Gundersens are also reaching out to many other experts with interviews and references to their work. You can subscribe to podcasts on their page, fairwinds.org. Come back for TUC Radio's next broadcast for an up-close interview of Arne and Maggie Gundersen. I finally met them in person when they came to California for a November 2015 speaking tour. TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. A conversation with Maggie and Arne Gundersen. Friends in Inverness put them up in a cabin in the woods just a quarter mile from the famous San Andreas earthquake fault. Maggie and Arne Gundersen came to California for a speaking tour at the end of 2015 and offered to meet me in the afternoon before giving a Fukushima update at the Point Reyes Dance Palace. I came down all the way from Mendocino, looking very much forward to meeting them in person. The Gundersens had become so familiar to me for the past 5 years with their fairwinds.org website and as a trusted source of information on the Fukushima disaster. Both worked in the nuclear industry, Maggie in public information, Arne as an engineer, and executive. I'm moved by people who question what they're doing, put in time and energy to reform an institution, have the courage to express their criticism, and in Arne's case, risk their livelihood and excellent salary by becoming a whistleblower. Arne was fired from Nuclear Energy Services in 1990. And as you will hear in a moment, Arne and Maggie Gundersen are a close team in the nuclear education work they're now doing. They just recently decided to redefine the word nuclear accident and are coming up with a fascinating reframing. I started by asking them a question that had troubled me for a long time. given that Arne Gundersen is one of only a handful of whistleblowers. How early did people in the nuclear industry become aware that they were dealing with a monstrously dangerous technology? Here is Maggie Gundersen.
You asked how long we've known about this. I think the nuclear industry knew this from the very beginning. We're finding new papers, new things have been released, documents that show they totally hid things from the American people. Otherwise, these atomic reactors, because that's what they are, whether you change the name to nuclear reactors or nuclear power, they're atomic reactors and they're connected with the atom bomb. And you can't deny that at all.
We met when we worked on a nuclear plant together. And for the first 20 years of my career, I was, you know, senior vice president in the nuclear industry. I found some license violations at the company I worked for. So I told the president of the company this, and he fired me. I told the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and they deliberately botched the inspection, and they were taking bribes. So then John Glenn, Senator John Glenn, took interest in the case and fired up a special inspection. And the inspection found out that all the six items that I had brought forward and two others had indeed occurred. They found out that the guy who ran the inspection deliberately tried to suppress the information. This is the NRC manager, and that they were taking bribes. So that was 1990. So essentially the first 20 years of my career, I firmly believed in nuclear. But even after that, I believed in nuclear, but I just didn't think it was well regulated. I never really understood how the nuclear industry has co-opted the regulator, and we don't have effective regulation now. So it was Fukushima Daiichi that finally pushed me over. This is a technology that can wipe out a country overnight. Mikhail Gorbachev has said that the accident at Chernobyl was responsible for the collapse of communism. It wasn't perestroika. He actually blames the accident at Chernobyl for, you know, essentially destroying the Soviet Empire. And Naoto Kan, who was the prime minister of Japan at the time of the accident, said the same thing. He said that, you know, he looked at the possibility of evacuating 35 million people. How are you going to do that? Accident. We're working on this.
We're working on reframing, because there is no such thing as a nuclear accident. There are systems in place in which the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the industry assesses how much financial and physical damage and human damage an event in a nuclear plant would do. And so much money or so many people are disposable. That's a good word, disposable. I never knew that when I told people these plants were safe. I never knew that.
Is that the famous cost benefit analysis?
Yes. They use probabilistic risk assessment, PRA. Roll a dice, see what happens, and the odds are. And that's not something you do with human lives or our planetary environment. We have only one Earth, and we can't make it inhabitable for all species.
The way the game is played at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is that they underestimate the probability of a disaster, and they also underestimate the cost to clean it up. So when you do that, of course, nuclear looks pretty darn good. But Fukushima Daiichi showed us that they're incredibly expensive to clean up. When it's over in Japan 100 years from now, they will have spent $500 billion cleaning up from those four reactors. So the price in dollars, let alone the human price, with 1 million cancers in Japan likely before this is all over, just way outweigh whatever benefits you're going to get. But it's our risk and the corporation's benefit. The corporations are making the profit, and we're taking the risk.
Yeah, in your report on the decommissioning of Vermont Yankee, I shouldn't be amazed to find that not only is it a private corporation, many people don't even know that your power is in private hands, but that this is a limited liability corporation.
I never thought of the fact that nuclear power is in private hands when you have a limited liability corporation. But the nuclear industry has changed over the last 20 years such that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission allowed these plants to be given away to private industry for pennies on the dollar. And private industry made an enormous amount of profit, but they never reinvested that profit back into the power plant. So you get debacles like Vermont Yankee and the leak, or worse yet, the tube failures at San Onofre. And all of those were caused because management was cheap and they didn't do it right. And they didn't want to get the public involved in the licensing process. So the net effect of this privatization of the nuclear industry is that when the plants run, the owners make a lot of money. When the plants break, the public stuck with the public pain.
Yeah, this whole issue of giving them an enormous trust fund that ratepayers ponied up over time. Not only did they give away the plant for free, they said, here's your bank account.
And at every plant, there's not enough money put aside for decommissioning. Not one plant in the country has enough. So that means the public's going to be tapped again. And that if it's a utility, they're just going to add it on to costs for the ratepayers. And if it's one of the merchant plants like Vermont Yankee, where a corporation, an energy corporation, owns it, then they could just eventually, limited liability corporation, could walk away and leave what's left to be cleaned up by taxpayers. That Vermont, for example, is a little state. There's not even 700,000 people in Vermont. So how are they going to afford, when we look at it now, it's as much as $1,000 per man, woman, and child in Vermont to pay for the extra costs.
There's many subsidies in the nuclear industry. The Price-Anderson risk insurance, where the public assumes the risk of a nuclear power plant blows up. But the hidden subsidy in the nuclear industry is decommissioning. What the Nuclear Regulatory Commission allows is that you don't have to dismantle a plant immediately. You're allowed to wait 60 years until you get enough money to decommission the plant. Well, in Vermont, you have to have a fully funded decommissioning fund when we build a windmill. But the Nuclear Regulatory Commission says Vermont Yankee can wait 60 years. I think a nuclear power plant is a little more dangerous than a windmill. You wouldn't allow a gas station to sit in your town with leaky tanks for 60 years. And yet the Nuclear Regulatory Commission looks the other way on nuclear power.
And here we're talking about a plant that hasn't blown up. Mm-hmm. Very often people say, oh, yeah, accident, you have to pay extra. But that's not true for just a normal plant that's shut down because of old age.
No, that's correct. None of the externalities, the things left outside of the realm of operations, are included in the costs either. For example, the mining and the mining cleanup, or all of the ongoing waste storage and where to put it and how to transport it and how to guard it from terrorism attack. None of that is calculated in any of the operations costs.
There was a uranium mine in Utah, at Moab, Utah. And the company that built the mine had this enormous dam loaded with all the junk that's left over from mining. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission told them that they had to set aside $6 million to clean it up. That was the decommissioning fund required. And when they shut down, it turned out to be a $1 billion project. And the solution was they went bankrupt And we, the citizens of the United States, got stuck cleaning up that mess. So when you hear about a nuclear power plant being cheap, the fuel is cheap, etc., it's because every accident and every mining disaster that they have are carried by the public, and only the successes get transmitted through in the cost of the fuel.
What's being done with the waste? I mean, that's another supposedly subsidized program. Didn't the U.S. government take on responsibility to come up with a safe repository for the high-level waste?
We'd answer it entirely differently. Go ahead, you start, and then I'll cut in.
When I get out of college, all the nuclear power plants in the country had fuel pools designed to hold 5 years of fuel. And the theory was that after 5 years, it would get shipped to a waste reprocessing facility and get turned right back around, and we'd make more fuel than we were using. It appeared to be endless, an endless cycle, a fuel cycle. In fact, it never was a fuel cycle. It was a fuel chain. It broke, and it starts and it ends, but it doesn't go round and round. So what's happened now is that we're storing all this nuclear waste in fuel pools, and as the fuel pools fill up, we're sticking it in dry cast storage. Now, in the 1980s and 1990s, the government stepped in and said, we'll take care of this nuclear waste. And they chose a spot in Nevada called Yucca Mountain. The reason they chose it has nothing to do with science, but it was because Nevada didn't have a lot of votes, and it was affectionately called the Screw Nevada Bill as it worked its way through the Senate and the House. And now Yucca Mountain's shut down because it doesn't seem to be technically correct, and politically it's unacceptable to the people who live in Nevada. And so we're stuck. We're storing all this waste above ground in dry cast storage for hundreds of years.
So Maggie, you have a different answer.
The technology simply does not exist. There is only one place in the world that believes that they have the technology, and that's in Finland. And they have dealt with building this huge underground bunker that has to hold the waste for 250,000 years, but they say they know it will only hold for 100,000 years. Plus, it's already filled, and they're still operating many, many more nuclear plants and producing much more waste. So they are only going to be able to store for 100,000 years a fraction of their waste. Any of the technologies developed anywhere else in the world don't work. The U.S. was counting on a form of encapsulation for some of its materials, and that doesn't work. Sweden did tests that show that it breaks apart in 100 years. This waste is the gift that keeps on giving. And when we haven't even had people, humans, species with language in that for that amount of time, how are we going to anticipate if the mines, salt mines, or the granite facilities like in Finland are marked in 10,000 years? How will people even know if that says that this is no trespassing? Will they have that same language? Will they write the same way? Or even worse, will another Hitler come along and want to take that material and use it to create bombs?
Some of that has to do with mixed oxide fuel. Mm-hmm. That was supposed to be a recycling event.
I'll cover that in a second.
Okay.
You know, there's 100 nuclear plants in the country, and before we ever figure a place to put it, we're going to have 100 dumps around the country where this spent nuclear fuel is going to be stored for as long as 100 years. The reprocessing of nuclear fuel is really done for bomb making. The plutonium that comes out of the reprocessing is a significant contributor to the making of atomic bombs. The Indians made their atomic bomb from reprocessed fuel. The Pakistanis made their atomic bomb from reprocessed fuel. North Koreans from reprocessed fuel. And the most frightening one is that Japan has enough plutonium now to make 1,000 nuclear warheads if they wanted to. So we've got the new regime there run by a man named Abe. He's the prime minister. And he wants to remilitarize Japan. And it's really frightening that their reprocessing program from commercial civilian nuclear plants is enough to make 1,000 nuclear bombs if they want to.
And just as concerning, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, is encouraging them to keep doing this reprocessing. The people of Japan don't want that plant to continue anymore. It's been operating for years and years and years and still doesn't work properly and keeps shutting down. And the Department of Energy is still encouraging them to do it as well. So we see it as part of a remilitarization that helps the Asia-Pacific plan by the U.S. government.
Actually, that's a fascinating comment because I wonder how much it has to do with global trade agreements and what's hidden behind them politically. Is this part of a strategy to isolate China?
Yeah.
That's what... I think that's true.
Yeah. You know, the Japanese have a unique perspective on nuclear power. The first bomb on Hiroshima was an enriched uranium bomb. So that uranium came out of the mine, ran through an enrichment facility, and then got dropped. The second bomb on Nagasaki was a plutonium bomb from reprocessed fuel from the Hanford reactors. So we had a plutonium bomb and a uranium bomb destroy two cities in Japan. Then about 10 years later, the Americans were testing a hydrogen bomb in the Pacific. And 100 miles away was a ship called the Lucky Dragon 5. And the hydrogen bomb was 10 times more explosive than scientists thought. It threw up a huge cloud of radiation, killed a couple of the crew members on the Lucky Dragon quickly, and the rest died horrible deaths over time. And the State Department was terrified that Japan would not be amenable to taking our nuclear ships into their harbors or into Okinawa. So the American State Department made a deal with the Japanese and said, we'll give you nuclear power plants because they're good, atoms for peace. And it took the Japanese mind off of the fact that, they had civilians die in a hydrogen bomb, and a uranium bomb, and a plutonium bomb. And then, of course, 30 years after that, they had the Fukushima Daiichi disaster. So as a country, they've experienced the whole gamut of problems with nuclear power. It's the beginning, I'm afraid, of a remilitarization of Japan, and they certainly have enough plutonium to become a world power in nuclear if they chose to be.
Actually, that reminds me of meeting an employee of the Hiroshima city paper. His job was to seek out nuclear sites, bomb or mining or nuclear power sites, and report on them to keep alive this thought that Japan would do everything it could to not have a repeat of this, of its own fate. Have you ever come across the very few people who are left in Japan who see that as their mission?
We have, with one of our board members. Chiho Kaneko has translated at the UN for the victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and she's worked extensively with some of them and has some real insight, and she did a beautiful blog post in Demystifying Nuclear Power, the blog on fairwinds.org on our website. And it brings you to tears to hear the stories. And she said so much of this she never learned. They were never taught in school. And it's only in the last decade or so as an international translator that she's been able to learn this much about her country's own history.
You know, the bomb occurred in 1945, so 70 years have gone by. So it's only the very young people who are 20 years old or younger at Nagasaki and Hiroshima who are still alive to tell the story. We had one story where a young girl saw her father standing in line for medical treatment, and she went over and tugged on his sleeve, and it wasn't his sleeve. His entire skin rolled off his arm into her hand, and he died shortly thereafter. I mean, this is a horrific way to destroy human beings, and I hope to heck it never gets tried again on this planet.
In a way, it brings us back to the issue that atomic nuclear power plants were really a result of bomb making.
Nuclear power plants are a result of bomb making. They were the Atoms for Peace program, and the U.S. government tried to foster using them around the world. The technology was shared. Peaceful Atom was part of the Eisenhower program. Even though President Eisenhower spoke against the militarization that we have now, and he said, never trust the military-industrial complex. And that is what we have, a military-industrial complex that uses the fuel to further bomb-making and to further the industries that support war around the world.
The time at Fukushima, that it's even safe to approach it, much less to work on on a totally different scale than 60 years.
The Japanese claim that they want to completely dismantle and eliminate all the radiation from the Fukushima site in the next 40 years. That's not going to happen. I was an executive in decommissioning of nuclear power plants, and when they're clean, it takes 10 or 20 years. And this site is anything but clean. The radiation levels are so high that not only will they kill a person, but they fry the electronics on the robots as they go into these areas. I also think it's terrible for the young Japanese men who will be working on the decommissioning, because the regime, the current regime, wants to do it quickly. They really want to do it quickly to show the Japanese population that nuclear safe, that we can get this done, we can get it behind us and move on. In fact, they're going to overexpose a generation of young Japanese men if they do that. My attitude is what the Russians did in the Ukraine on Chernobyl. Build a cover over it, let it sit for 100 years or more, and then go in. 100 years, the radiation exposures will be 10 or 15 times lower. So it's a good thing to wait if you're really concerned about the Japanese gene pool and the genetic damage to the workers that this massive cleanup will entail. On top of that, it's going to be $500 billion to clean it up. It's a mind-boggling amount of money. And the Japanese government doesn't want to admit that to its people, because they'll turn against nuclear. There's too much money in the process, and Japanese banks have bankrolled these 50 plants that are presently shut down. They want their money back. And the Japanese government is going to make sure that happens by turning these power plants back on.
This was a conversation with Maggie and Arnie Gundersen. I visited them in the guest cabin in Inverness, West Marin, just before the Fukushima update presentation in Point Reyes Station, California. The date was November 21, 2015. As I am producing this program on the fifth anniversary of the Fukushima disaster in March 2016, Arnie Gundersen is spending a month in Japan to assess the status of the cleanup. He writes reports and calls in updates from his tour. Even though polls show that at least 70% of Japanese do not want the nuclear power plants reopened that were shut down 5 years ago, the Abe government is determined to put many of them back online and has begun the process. Visit their website, fairwinds.org, for videos and podcasts, as well as blog posts on current events, expert witness reports on nuclear safety issues, a book list, media coverage, and much more. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
And this is KBOO in Portland. It's 9:59 a.m. Coming up at 10, we have Chris Andre bringing you Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary, followed at 10:15 by Flashpoints, our good friends and siblings in struggle at Pacifica Radio, a KPFA in Berkeley. We thank them for their participation in bringing these issues to the fore. So keep it locked right here on your community radio.
Cascadia. Today is Friday.